Everybody is here. Welcome, welcome, welcome to our second session in our social justice info series. Tonight we will be discussing defunding the police and what does this really mean. My name is Dr. Talia Moore, and I am over the criminology program here at Holy Names. And I have the pleasure of working with my colleague Freddie Gutierrez, who's also a part of this collaboration in this program series that we're offering. So I'd like to introduce my co-host, Freddie.
Thank you, Dr. Moore. Yes, I am Freddie Gutierrez, the director of the Center for Social Justice and Civic Engagement. This is round two of our Social Justice Info series. We're very excited to continue to explore this series of issues. For those of you who don't know much about the Center for Social Justice and Civic Engagement, really a warehouse for opportunities for service and collaboration in any which way that you can imagine. Come on by Monday or Tuesday if you're on campus, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. in Brennan 82, or reach out to us, Center for Social Justice at hnu.edu. Thank you.
All right. Well, I'd like to go ahead and introduce our esteemed panelists. First, I'd like to introduce Deputy Chief Armstrong, representing the Oakland Police Department. Hello, Chief. Welcome.
I'm sorry. As many of these Zoom meetings that I'm a part of, you would think I'd be used to this by now, but it's still challenging. So thank you for being here. Thank you for having me. I think this is a discussion that's being had in many places throughout law enforcement and communities across the country. And so Oakland obviously is taking on reimagining policing in our community. And so so I appreciate having a discussion and being able to share our thoughts about the changes that we'll be seeing in the near future.
All right. Thank you, Chief. And our next esteemed panelist is Ms. Rosie Torres. She's representing the Oakland Unified School District.
Hi, everybody. I'm so glad you're here, and I'm really honored to be on this panel with the Deputy Chief and with the hardworking folks at Holy Names. Thank you for inviting me, and it is my final year on the OUSD School Board. I serve District 5, and I was elected in 2012. I like to say that was a celebration because Obama won. Then I was elected in 2016, and I like to say it was a bit of a funeral because, who was elected? And so it's been an up and down 8 years, but I definitely have some proud things that I can share during my presentation.
Right on. Well, thank you both. All right, so we're going to go ahead and get started with the questions.
Yay.
All right. So just a little bit, and this question is extended to the both of you. If you could just share a little bit about your career experience, working in your respective fields, and, just kind of talk about that for a brief moment, if you wouldn't mind.
Should I go first?
Yes, please.
Okay, we can go back and forth with Deputy Chief. We'll go back and forth. That'll be fair. So my current career I'm a board trustee for OUSD. I was, as I was saying, elected in 2012 and again in 2016. All the odd numbers are elected on the presidential cycle in Oakland. So this year it'll be 1, 3, 5, and 7 for city council and school board. 4 seats. I ran in 2012 as a result of being pushed out there. I wasn't seeking political office, but I was very active on boards as a board of director for various organizations serving youth in East Oakland, serving to get women elected, and especially women of color, and then working with lawyers in groups that are for more diversity in the legal profession because I'm an attorney. And so I served on many different types of boards, and I'm very vocal about wanting better representation of everyone who looks like the people in Oakland in capacities of making very big decisions that affect our lives. So I was asked to run and initially said no, and then was asked again and said, give me 30 days to think it over. and then I eventually decided to run. And the really hard part about making the decision is that as an attorney, I have been running my own law firm since 2004. I was previously living in Stockton, where I was born, primarily raised, and I had a four-year-old, and I moved to Oakland and was starting my business, and I came from government. I was a prosecutor, and I was a county counsel in Stockton, and when I was thinking about the running phase, it was, can I run my business? Can I also be on school board? Can I also be a good mom to a 12-year-old? And I can tell you that I don't sugarcoat. I'm a very direct and blunt person. And all those things, my daughter, I think I suffered in that relationship because I didn't have as much time. My business suffered because I couldn't train my employees as I should have been. And I lost clients and I lost a lot of income. But would I do it again? Yes. For the sake of serving 42,000 students in Oakland Unified. And one of the pivotal reasons I decided to run, even though it seemed like I'm going to lose my business, I'm going to lose time with my daughter, was that I know I experienced racism in school. And I grew up, as I said, in Stockton, but my schools were in Lodi. I was bused. And I definitely felt racism by teachers, by staff. The institution of the school was geared towards students that didn't look like me and that weren't poor like me. And so I didn't get to say that when I got on OUSD board, but I get to say it now as I'm leaving because we're having very different conversations about race. We're starting to finally have honest conversations about race, white supremacy, lack of black, lack of anti-black sentiments, anti-Latino, anti-immigrant. And so I ran just thinking about my own experience in middle school and this awful feeling in my stomach about how a teacher made me feel. And I thought, if that's still going on, then I want to be able to bring my perspective as a mother and as a former, you know, public school student. So that's been my lens for a lot. And as a prosecutor, I quit that job feeling as though I was putting people in jail for being black, brown, or uneducated to get a better job, to be a part of the fabric of society in a legal way versus an illegal way. And so I went out and did criminal defense, and I wanted to know why people were choosing crime. And I treated every client with respect who was arrested because I said, well, what was your education like? What was your experience, you know, in school? How did you, what were your grades like? And I found that people really do want to have the life of dignity, but they were given a bad education. Mm. So what were their options? Crime. So I ran on those sentiments, and I'll stop there.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Torres. All right, Chief.
Well, you know, my story's a little bit different, right? But, you know, for me, I was born and raised in Oakland. I went to Oakland Public Schools. I graduated from McClimas High School, and so Oakland is my home. It's where I still live. It's the place that I, you know, love very much. But, you know, I grew up in a very challenged neighborhood. I grew up in deep West Oakland. They call it the Lower Bottom. And so I grew up around a lot of gang violence. I grew up around a lot of things that my mother didn't think was good for me to see. You know, and then in 1985, my brother, who was attending an Oakland public school, Oakland Tech, he was killed on campus. He was shot in the hallways on his way to class. And I think for the first time growing up in West Oakland, you kind of were taught that we didn't have a relationship with police, that we lacked trust in police, and that we didn't have any confidence in the police ability to provide true public safety for our community. And so that is what I was brought up around. And then all of a sudden in 1985, you see this, you know, this tragedy happens to you. And then all of a sudden you become dependent on law enforcement to sort of, you know, help you, you know, get some level of justice or feel like at least somebody's being held accountable for the actions that they took. In the trauma that was caused to you and your family. And so that always resonated with me. It also resonated with me that I had several classmates and friends that were killed or went to jail. And so as I, embarked on an athletic career, I played basketball in high school and was fortunate enough to get a basketball scholarship. But also I recognized that once I got to college at Oregon State, I quickly realized that academically I was not prepared for a major four-year university. And so some of the things that Ms. Torres was just speaking of, I mean, I've experienced them firsthand that my school, my academic institution did not prepare me to compete at the highest levels academically. And so that caused me a challenge and forced me to have to transfer to a junior college and sort of start over and reinvest in my education and my athletic career. And then I was able to get my AA degree and then transfer and get a scholarship to Sacramento State, where I finished in criminal justice and was able to play basketball there and then eventually come back home. Because really, I thought when I left for college, what could I bring back? We always had a motto at McClime. It's about community, right, and family. And if you know, I know Ms. Moore, you know, friends of mine, that people that I know, you know, McClime has a huge connection. It's a family. We call it the Mac family. And so it was for me about, like, what could I bring back, you know, to West Oakland? What could I do to my community? What could I, how could I be an asset? I thought I'd go to the Alameda County Probation Department. So I went to work for the Alameda County Probation Department as a probation officer and a probation counselor. And what an awesome experience to have an opportunity to work with young people that, you know, have come from similar backgrounds as I did, and then have a chance to be a role model to some of them and really sort of teach them, you know, the experiences that I've learned, and just reassure them that they still could be great people in our community, and that this was just an opportunity for them to change their course in life. And so that was powerful for me. But then it also brought to mind, how can I actually get in front of this? Right? Like, once they're inside the institution, the decision's already been made. They've been impacted by the criminal justice system. How can I get in front of that? And so that led me into policing, to be quite honest, because I began to ask officers, like, hey, how are you making decisions about who goes to jail and who doesn't? And they told me how much discretion they had. And I thought, well, that's an opportunity to make some decisions out there to save people's lives and maybe divert people from the criminal justice system into something different. And so in 1998, I took on something I never thought I would do, is wear a police uniform, and I became a police officer. I came into a building into an institution that I didn't feel comfortable in, right? That here it is that I'm born and raised in Oakland, and I'm going into an institution with very few people who are actually from Oakland, but now I feel uncomfortable and feel like I don't belong. And so it was this culture that I had to get used to, but I made a commitment to myself early on that I would remain grounded in who I am, remain grounded in my own values of how I was brought up in my community, and to continue to make sure that I stay true to what I said I was going to do, which was attempt to bridge the gap between law enforcement in the community. And that's been my work over the last almost 23 years, is just really trying to connect law enforcement with community, trying to come up with progressive ideas around policing, and trying to, you know, reduce the racial disparities that African Americans, experience when it comes to law enforcement. And so I've done a lot of work around that, and I'm sure we'll get into some of those things, but that's really been my mission and my cause.
All right. Thank you. Thank you both for that. And this question is kind of like a carriage over from that. So just from your personal perspective, and given your years of service in your respective careers, how does the current state of affairs between the community at large and law enforcement resonate with you? I'll go to you first, Chief, and then Ms. Torres.
Yeah, I think, I think one of the most critical things for me is that I have to be honest about who I am, right? Because I'm an African American, before I put on this uniform, and when I take it off, I'm a Black man. So I'm not, there's this thing that I often tell even police officers, right? There's this immutable characteristic that I have that I can't get rid of. This is who I am, and I have to be true to who I am. And so the idea for me really is in this moment, as we see tragedies happen across the country at the hands of law enforcement, I really feel like, for me, there's an opportunity as I sit in this space of leadership of how do I take in, the community's desire to see something different, to experience something different, and be able to put that, move that forward in terms of changing policies, changing practices, so that all people feel like they can be treated fair, that they can be treated with dignity and respect, and that they can understand that what a police department is supposed to provide, which is public safety, and they can, and hopefully help contribute to their own safety in their communities, and hopefully that I can, you know, inspire other officers, my department, right, to see things differently, to understand that we can't arrest our way out of problems, that the object of this job is to the sanctity of life, and that when we make decisions out there, we should understand that my job is to not make the community more unsafe, right? That you know, we have to not only reduce violence in the community, but we also have to be cognizant of police violence. And so we can't be the contributors to the problem that we're trying to solve. And so just how, but how do you break this culture, right? The last thing I'll say, you know, is that, you know, one of my mentors, his name is Ron Davis, and he's the former head of the cops office, and now he's in Sacramento working with the governor. But look, he started off at Oakland PD, and he was here for 20 years, and he was, him and I remain friends, and we talk. And he said to me, he said, hey, I want you to understand, as far as you go in this career, he said, I want you to understand, culture eats policy for breakfast. Right. And so if you don't change the culture, it doesn't matter what policy you change. Right. So you can put in any policy you want. But if you don't change the minds and hearts of those that wear uniforms, then nothing will change. Right. And so that has been the focus. How do you change the hearts and minds while you change policy so that people accept where the community wants you to be in terms of how you provide police services?
All right. Well, thank you, Chief. I really like that. Culture eats policy for breakfast. I had to write that down.
Me too.
Yeah. Me too. I like that. All right, Ms. Morris. Yes.
Can you restate the question? Because I get. I'm a lawyer, so sometimes I just answer what I want to answer, not what the question is. That's a thing we do, right? To win.
No worries. So I was just saying, from your perspective and your years of service in your respective field, how does the current state of affairs between the community at large and law enforcement resonate with you?
So I think that similar to what I said earlier about the current state of the community and how it intersects with law enforcement is that people who don't have a problem with law enforcement, people who look a certain way, people who know the police will come, they're in a certain zip code, certain neighborhood, certain amount of wealth, they don't understand oftentimes why people in poorer neighborhoods who are people of color will say, police aren't going to come here. We call the time. If we don't say there's a gunshot, this, that, and the other. You know, I think it's an amazing time to have been part of the marches. I marched with my daughter and her, like, 10 friends down Broadway over the injustice of George Floyd, and the community was very diverse. And every time I watched the march or my daughter went to the marches, I asked her, how was the crowd, you know, what was going on? And then we see Portland, and we see this very strange ongoing diversity growing, that it is people marching for justice that can call the police and don't worry about being mistaken for the perpetrator, right? They're the ones that call. And so I think that things are going to shift because of young people and their willingness to be brave and to be bolder than their parents. I like to tell people, in the 60s, you were either marching with Martin Luther King for racial justice, for civil rights, or you were on that other path, which looked very different and had very different types of people, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. That's about the same time, right? The 60s. So it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll for some people, or it was the civil rights movement, extremely painful fight, right, for life, for dignity, and for freedom. And so those kids of those people who took the sex, drugs, rock and roll are the ones marching today, are the ones that are realizing our parents totally dropped the ball. They should have been out there. They should have been demanding change. Instead, they were comfortable. So I'm excited about young people. I'm excited about the change that's coming and how broad it is. I think the thing is that what the chief said about culture eats policy for lunch, that's exactly right in schools. when we have a very anti-Black, anti-immigrant culture in our schools, we can't even keep teachers of color, okay? And I said, I don't mince words, OUSD has a problem increasing the number of Black and Latino teachers. Why? Because the culture is not right for it. It spits them out. And I, every year for 8 years, I've watched as students cry because of teachers that are being let go after their two-year time period before they become a permanent contract employee, and they get pushed out. And it's not the teacher's skill. It's usually that they don't fit the culture of the school. 70% almost of our teachers are white. 10% of our students are white. So we have an issue in this country with the teacher workforce not reflecting the students. The California students in K through 12 are 76% students of color. 53% are Latino alone out of 6.2 million kids. But teachers in Oakland make up about 11% Latino, African-American about 12%. So it's a problem. It's a culture problem because we, as a board, we create policy. What we hear from people, be it teachers, be it parents, former students like the chief, is that, yeah, you got a lot of great policies, but nobody's following them. Nobody's respecting them. No one cares. It's business as usual. And so every year I struggle with the fact that OUSD's numbers don't change very much when it comes to Black and Latino teachers, and even API, our Asian Pacific Islander friends. We need to do better. We need to enforce, and the fact of the matter is that for students who are white, to have a Black teacher, a male Black teacher early on, to have a Latina teacher early on, would make a world of a difference. My daughter went through all OUSD schools and did not see a Latina teacher until 10th grade taking Spanish at Oakland Tech. And I thought, what a pathetic stereotype we are, right? She didn't see a Latino teacher ever. She had a couple African-American male teachers in high school, but it was just really, to me, it's still pretty bad. And so I want students to see diversity in the classroom from the get, because that shapes the kid. That tells the kid what's possible. And a kid should see themselves in their teacher, right? So that's a really big issue. I think that at this point, we will see more people of color go into teaching. I think that that's what's changing, right? We're fighting for ethnic studies. We have a governor that performed some atrocious act yesterday by vetoing the bill. I'm devastated and disgusted by that. And Jerry Brown did the same thing. But the fact of the matter is that while these things happen and are bluntly in front of us, we can push back and say, I'm going to be the teacher that changes the course of students. I'm going to be the person who then becomes a principal to run a school and do it in a way that is a different culture. Because even if I gave you the numbers of our principals that are white, you know, it's very much like the teacher workforce. And so it's not that having white teachers and white principals is bad. It's the ratio. And it's that in 40, 50 years, nothing has changed. That's a problem. And so I find that, you know, after 8 years, I've done some good, but there's so much more that needs to be done in the school board. And so I'm supporting quite a few of the candidates running now, and they're all very diverse. And they're all men, which is also really interesting. But I just think that, you know, for the young people listening, watching, if you even have an inkling of becoming a teacher, the other thing about it is you don't have to be one thing forever, right? You're going to live a longer life than generations before you, which means you could have three careers. You could have four careers. People that are practicing lawyers, after 20 years, they hang it up. It's a lot of stress. And then they go into teaching. Or they were teachers and then they became lawyers, and any number of things. So I think if, you know, you have a duty to get in front of young people and teach for 10, 15 years, you might fall in love with it, of course. And that's something I dream about. It's not being a lawyer anymore, maybe being a teacher at a community college, because I'm a product of community college as well. We were very poor when I was growing up, and so I didn't think I was going to go to college. My mom just said, get a job when you graduate high school, and I did. So last thing I would say is that I once sat on a panel with Delaine Easton. Delaine Easton ran for governor. And Delaine Easton was an assemblywoman, a city councilwoman on the peninsula side of the Bay. And she said at that panel, I sat with her, a budget is a value statement. A budget is a value statement. So when you think about budgets of the state, K through 12 is woefully under budgeted. So our students are in schools that don't have the great books, don't have computers in the library, don't have librarians in the library, much less books on the shelves. And then our cities are strangely not supportive of things that we need, which is more mental health practitioners, more counselors. There's a lot of things the city could also do to fill that gap, but it doesn't. And then lastly, OUSD. We were budgeting over $6 million approximately for police. And I didn't have police in my school district in Stockton and Lodi. And I don't think that our students of color primarily deserve to have a police department when they are missing books and computers and all of the things that they deserve, like the kids in San Ramon, like the kids in Livermore, like the kids in Lafayette or Orinda. And so I felt that the budget being a value statement, we do not need to budget over $6 million for police when we sit within a city that has a police department. So that was the essence of my removing the police department with a policy called the George Floyd Resolution. Because we need to walk the walk instead of just talking the talk. And that's really important. And a lot of elected officials just talk the talk and don't back it up with action out of fear. So I think I'll stop there.
All right. Well, one last question from me before I pass it over to Freddie here. we're going to get into this, but we might as well get into it now, right? Curious. So why do you believe some people in community groups are advocating for defunding the police?
Yeah. I'll start. So as a prosecutor, as I said, 90% of the people, if not more, in the court of Stockton when I was a prosecutor were people of color. I went on the criminal defense side and worked for someone for a year, and I was sent to courts in places like Auburn, which is going towards Tahoe. I was sent to court in places like Marysville, Woodland, basically places that have no diversity, but still the courtroom was filled with 90% people of color. And so I would just walk in, and at first I would be shocked because I thought, did you round up all the people of color and arrest them? It's a lens, right? It's a lens. And so when I got to Oakland and started practicing criminal defense, I mean, Oakland is very diverse, right? But when I was elected, I was approached by Black Organizing Project, the folks at the West Oakland nonprofit, and they had been compiling the data, the research around youth who have contact with police once, even unjustified because they're just a group of Black or Latino boys hanging out after getting out of a movie theater, and then somebody thinks they're doing something bad or they're up to no good and starts calling the police. And once they have that initial contact, the data showed that they will continually have contacts with police that are not warranted. Now, as a youth who was running with a rough crowd, when I was approached by police and I wasn't doing anything wrong, I definitely it created in me a bad attitude. So that when I was approached by police thereafter with my friends, I was very mouthy and I probably could have gone to juvie. I mean, who knows? But I talked my way out of things very fast. But I can see why that data and that research is there, because once you have that one unwarranted contact, now you feel like you're being picked on. And now you feel like you have to defend yourself and you're going to try to get out of it, right? So the data that Bob presented to me when I joined the board in 2013 was we have too many contacts with police in our schools, whether it's your internal department, whether it's the out department. And ultimately, I felt that we need to do something about that. We don't need a school-to-prison pipeline. And we were contributing by having our own police department, right? And so the community in West Oakland, primarily the African-American community that was working with BOP, that makes up the organization BOP, and then I met with Latino organizations in Fruitvale and East Oakland that also feel the same way and hear the same story from boys. I would just be hanging out at getting some groceries at the liquor store, and then police pull up on me or whatever, and of course, you get a bad attitude, right? So you start to carry that angst. You start to carry that negativity. And then, you like the chief said, you start to then have a certain dynamic around police, not good for us. Police are good for some people. And that's true, right? So we now know, because we're living the post-George Floyd death, what is coming out and coming out and coming out. So I think that with the school district and the city of Oakland being extremely diverse, this the communities all over the city were ready to hear that we did not need to fund police over $6 million. And the men in prison, there are also statistics around the men in prison who are primarily men of color. You know, it turns out they had learning disabilities. Turns out they didn't get any services for those learning disabilities, whether it be dyslexia or hearing or visually impaired or whatever, right? Learning disabilities of any kind, dyslexia. They didn't get services because they went to poor schools. They didn't have the money for the speech therapist or the whatever type of therapist. And so that's a really huge tragedy that we have so much untapped talent sitting behind bars because we don't fund schools. So in that regard, I feel like the data is there, the issues are real, and ultimately we need to be putting money behind students and closing what I call the opportunity gap. I don't buy into achievement gaps. I think every single one of our students can achieve at equally high levels. I say if you were not given opportunities to go get tutoring, to go into sports, to learn what it is to be part of a team, be a team player, this and that, then you didn't know how to conduct yourself in class. And then your teacher said, go to the office. And then you get suspended, you know, and it just starts that spiral out of control. So that's what I think is really important, is that we just hold allegiance to what we budget.
Right. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Torres. All right, Chief, why do you believe some people, community members, are advocating for defunding the police?
Well, I think that, you know, in light of George Floyd and many other incidents that we've seen, excessive force and murder of unarmed African-American men across the country, I think it's something that we've dealt with as a community for many years. And I think our community has reached a breaking point where they're unwilling to accept that anymore, right? That this system that was built to do exactly what it is that it's doing is not working. And I accept that. It's the idea, you know, and even why I even got into policing, right, was to sort of produce a system that works for my community, right, that produces true public safety. Now I will say to you that obviously in being, you know, being in this career for many years, I think there's a lot of systems and structures in place right now, right, that contribute to why we see some of the things that even Ms. Torres is talking about, right, that the lack of support, in the African-American community in our education system. I went to high school in McClimas where here is a high school where I'm an athlete attempting to receive a scholarship, but we only had three elective classes that I could take at the time, right? And so an insufficient amount of resources to even prepare me to be able to compete academically, right? Or even almost to even qualify for the scholarship. I mean, and so that was something that I felt really upset about at the time. And it's funny because, you know, people think, you know, as a cop that I'm not an advocate, but in 1989, I actually led a march to the Oakland Unified School District's main office because they had cut out all of our programs at McClimas. We used to have an auto shop, and we used to have driver's ed training at our school. All those support resources that was available at our high school had been stripped from us. And so we all had some serious concerns, right? And it goes back to sort of other things that have been said already, that, you know, the idea that you don't want young African-American men or others to have contact with law enforcement. But here it is, you took away our ability to go to driver's training and receive a license, right? And now for people like us that didn't have money, that means that we have to make a difficult choice, right? Either you drive without a license or either you walk to wherever you go. And so I just think you, to put kids into that position to make that decision is very tough, particularly when you don't have businesses in West Oakland, right? You don't have employment, places where you can go and actually get a job. I have to get to where to another destination or location to work, but you're not helping me to receive the same license that the kids at Skyline can get, right? Or the kids at other high schools can get. And so that's where the inequity started from, right? And so when we get to defunding, defunding one system does not improve the entire system. Economically, we've been failed in West Oakland, right? I grew up in subsidized housing. Nobody talked about a path to home ownership, right? We didn't even have a grocery store in West Oakland for many years, right? But people talk about the health of our community, right? The lack of investment in health care, the lack of investment in mental health, right? Services for our mentally ill community, right? So there's so many places where people don't understand, like, some of the things that even police have to respond to is the lack of investment by government. And I say the system is producing exactly what it wants. And so it's unfortunate that the level of violence that we see in our community demands that we have a system to go in and to be able to protect people and keep people safe. Yeah, we've had 9 homicides in the last 9 days and over 50 shootings in the city of Oakland. Now, some people use those as numbers because I'm somebody who's lost a loved one. I can tell you that those are people, right? It is not, for me, it ain't 70 homicides. It's 70 people with 70 families that are dealing with trauma at the hands of people in our own community. So we have to have an honest conversation about what is producing the outcome, right? You can defund a system and not fix the problem, right? Because what I'm going to say is that the system is doing exactly what it's designed to do. If I don't give you fair opportunity, if I don't give you jobs with equal and fair wages, then you force people into making tough decisions. I grew up with guys that grew up just like me, that ended up selling drugs, getting involved in crime, and they weren't bad people. You know, they were people whose families couldn't afford to put food on the table. They were young people who couldn't get shoes or do things that they wanted to do like other young people. And so they did the only thing that they were exposed to. And so I'm saying to community that, okay, I'm fine with restructuring the police department. But I'm also suggesting that we examine all these systems that produce the outcomes that make people believe that we need a policing system like this, right? And so I don't think you can fix one part of this broken system and think that it's going to solve the problem. I think you have to look at the system in its totality and figure out how can we give young people in our community a fair chance at being successful from the beginning, where police are not necessarily important to our community or as important as it is at this point. And so I just think it's the process of how we get there. And so you hear us in Oakland saying reimagine it, right? That's really our idea of figuring out how we can divert funds and do this in a way that doesn't compromise people's safety, right? Figuring out how we can take away money from police budget and then invest in things that police officers shouldn't be doing. And one of the things I can tell you is that I've told you my background, and nothing that you've heard told you that I was a mental health therapist, right? So the idea that I'm the first responder to mental illness calls says that I'm ill prepared to handle this particular group of people who have real needs, right? So why not invest the money in mental health therapists that actually can properly serve this community? Right. It actually will save you money because you can get them the help that they need, and then you won't have to call law enforcement to respond over and over. Right. If there's unsheltered population, it is not a crime to be homeless. Right. Police should not have to deal with homeless issues. But unfortunately, when you don't have other systems and structures in place, people call police, right? Instead of being able to call services that can be able to go out and provide the support that those individuals who are unsheltered need desperately, right? How can I get into transitional housing, right? How can I get help for whatever, issues that may be causing me to be in this way, employment opportunities, whatever that might be, but that really is not a role of law enforcement. So just trying to figure out what is the law enforcement lane that produces public safety that we're all okay with, but understanding what we shouldn't be doing, allowing those that specialize in those areas to actually provide that service. And so that's where I think reimagining becomes important, because I think we would all be ill-fated to think that human beings are not going to do things that that shock the conscience of all of us. I've been doing this too long and seen too many bad things and seen too many people make really tragic decisions to know that as human beings, people make decisions that can alter society. But I will say that, but it should be a department that is focused around dealing with those things and not necessarily other things. And I've worked with Black Organizing Project, and I know if you remember, I was a schools commander some years ago and organized with, worked closely with Black Organizing Project to remove our officers outside of the schools when we had the schools contract. We also, they asked us to not arrest students inside of schools, and I made the agreement to not arrest a student on an OUSD campus. They also asked us when there was a time where somebody did have to be arrested and not be on campus and then not be the officer assigned to the school. So that officer can continue to build relationships and not bring fear to the young people that at some point he may arrest them. And so, I worked extensively with BOP to do, initiatives that really help to make school safety respectful and let kids learn in that environment and be free of being in fear of law enforcement. And so I do think that there is a lot to learn from working with community organizing groups around how, you know, we can do this in a better and more effective way.
Excellent. Thank you, Chief Armstrong. I just want to appreciate the both of you for providing very thorough and thoughtful answers. I know that all this is going to serve us very well. Chief Armstrong, this question for you. As an agency, how are officers prepared to deal with community backlash over incidents such as the George Floyd murder and other more recent ones? Is there an official stance taken department-wide?
We take a stance that we condemn excessive force. We condemn the murder of George Floyd. What we seen was not consistent with police work. That was a clear violation of the law. And we're, you know, I'm happy personally, and I think organizationally, we've had these discussions that he was charged with the proper crime, which is murder, because that's what we saw. The techniques that were used there is not consistent with any training that we have, and that we have taken a proactive approach, even in Oakland, to implement new policy around the not using the carotid restraint on people's, you know, necks at any time, and then a new policy on positional asphyxia, which is really putting people in a position where we reduce their ability to breathe, right? And so just being cognizant of those things. And so I'll say that, you know, all of these things that we see happening across the country, to be a department that we want to be a learning department. And really, for me, I'm watching these things as they occur and seeing, are there lessons to learn from these incidents so they don't happen in Oakland? Is there policies that we have that need to be changed? Really examining our own practices and our training to see, hey, let's just make sure that this type of thing is not being trained within the department. Let's go back and examine our policies to make sure that we are not authorizing these type of actions. So I think, you know, for us, I think it's first condemning those actions, but it's also being proactive about looking at your own policies and practices and making sure that you're not teaching anything that might lead to that type of outcome as well. And so I think law enforcement officers across the country are beginning to have those conversations. And then within the Oakland Police Department, one of the things I preach often is that you have to be in line with your community's values, right? And so as a police department, if you're in Oakland, you have to be in line with the Oakland values. When you see these protests and you see people standing up for justice and social justice issues, you have to listen. You have to say that this is the community saying to me what they don't want to see and what they don't want law enforcement to be engaged in. And you, as a law enforcement leader, as a chief, you have to say, okay, I need to make some adjustments, because community has a right to have input into how they're policed. And so our police commission in Oakland is the strongest police commission in the country, and I think their voices are very clear to us, and I hear them very frequently. And so we are making adjustments to policies and practices, and we're doing it in a collaborative way. But we know that those community values are being brought to us from the community through our police commission, and they're holding us accountable to make changes when they're necessary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So condemning the action, which is not ultimately aligned with the community values, and as an institution trying to mirror reflect those community values, and making an assessment and looking internally. Thank you, Chief Armstrong. Okay, Rosie, so with these sorts of incidents, such as the murders that have happened this year, another officer-involved incidents, what sort of influence does that have on school district policy?
Well, I guess for us, the way it has an influence on policy is, well, at this stage, we have an opportunity to say we bring that money back into our general fund. We eliminate a police department because we are an institution for education. We are not an institution for policing, right? You know, justification at times from people who wanted the police department was, you know, well, you have kids that might bring weapons to school, or you might have a person on the campus who comes with a weapon, an adult. But that's why we have the city police department is my response to that, right? We also had a history where there was violence at a board meeting many, many years ago towards a superintendent. And you had this very extremist group that did that harm. I think it's important to think about the fact that we can't prevent everything, right? We can't prevent everything. And we had something like 6 officers, but we had 84 schools. And then we had a bunch of security officers at schools wearing a uniform, but they're not police. They're just like a security officer, like you'd see at the mall or whatever. And so we were spending a lot of money on people who looked like they could be a police, or we had 6 police officers, and we had the cars and all of that expense, right? And I just didn't see it. And so what we needed was that money to get realigned to what we were cutting and cutting and cutting. And the chief said they cut sports, they cut auto mechanics, they cut this and that. And that's all I ever hear for 8 years. How many things have been cut? But that goes up to the state. That goes up to the state because that's where we get the majority of our budget. We also get money from the feds. Typically, fed money is tied to specific programs like special education and this and that, Title I schools that are low-income schools. So the money usually has a lot of strings from the feds, but the state money is more general, and it's just been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So then you're cutting auto mechanics, you're cutting cooking, you're cutting things that are general skills that everybody should have, right? In the 70s, around 73, there was a bill passed called Prop 13. So for those of you on the call, 34 of you, Prop 13 was in the 70s, and it basically was a tax change for homeowners and property owners like Disneyland. So what happened was, in order to keep taxes really low on property, Prop 13 was created to say your property tax can only grow up so much every year. And we're talking 2%. So even if your property goes up 10% in a year, you're only going to pay tax on 2%. So since the 70s, California was in the top 5 for spending per student, per pupil. When that bill passed, we went like this. When I got on the board in 2013, guess where we were? Number 47 out of 50 states. We were in the top 5 for spending per pupil. We're talking like $14,000, $15,000, $16,000 per kid for programs, sports, and auto mechanic, and driver's license training, and whatnot. So we were number up in the 5, 4 and 5, you know, went back and forth with like Connecticut and other very wealthy states on the East Coast, and now we were 47? And Prop 13 taxes became very depressed. That's where we get a big chunk of money. So you will see on your ballot this November a proposition to undo Prop 13 to say pay your fair share so we can fund schools the way they should be. And we should have the respect of giving money per student so we can get back in the top 10 at least, because we're the 6th largest economy in the world. We're the 6th largest economy in the world. We're bigger than most countries that are small, our economy. But we will not stay a large economy if people are illiterate or continue to be locked up in prisons. We can't compete. You just can't. So for me, it's a no-brainer to undo Prop 13, starting with commercial property. Some people don't realize that Disneyland is paying taxes at a rate from the 70s, but the tickets have gone up from when I used to go as a kid, and it was probably $20 to get in. It's now like $180 to get in. So they're making all that money, but they're paying taxes from the 70s. So they're making billions off of us. And then we're not getting the money for schools. So I just have to say that because it is on the ballot this year, and I'll look it up when I'm not talking about what the ballot measure is. So that's one thing. Budgets are value statements, right? And the reason that passed Prop 13 was they were predicting the size of families of white versus people of color. And I spoke with a demographer once who was one of the people who did the study at UCLA, and he said, when I presented the data to the people in Sacramento who were going to pass this legislation, and I said, so in about 30 years, the majority of the kids will be black and brown in public schools, not white, like it was in the 70s. It was white. And those people in Sacramento said, I don't want to pay taxes to fund somebody else's kid to get an education. That's exactly what this man said, this demographer. So not paying the house tax, the commercial tax, was because they don't want to fund schools that are public, that are primarily filled with black and brown kids, the others, right? You're othered. So that's pathetic. And so I lost my train of thought as far as what I was supposed to be talking about. But that's just such an important thing because you have college students and you're all going to vote. I know you're going to vote in November. And voting to fund you and your baby brother and baby sister's schools, that's really critical. So the fact of the matter is that we could be doing so much more for our kids. We could be doing better sports programs. We have a problem. We just settled a lawsuit. Girls' programs are being cut faster than boys. And yet there's a law out there called Title IX. Boys and girls should get the equal amount of sports. I mean, there's just so many violations when you don't have money, right? And until you get, and this is why I tell people all the time, until you sue us at OUSD, you won't see change. We're not going to voluntarily change because people don't like to do things different. They like to do whatever comes very natural, which is to do the same old, same old, same old thing. And I know the chief sees that in the police department, right? So it always comes down to being forced. So when I meet parents who say, this is going on with my student and da-da-da-da, I'm like, get a lawyer. Just get a lawyer because they won't change. And they look at me like, you mean sue you? And I'm like, sue me. Sue OUSD or you will not see change. And that's the nature of my job is until you sue someone and win, you don't see change. And so I know I'm advocating off the cuff a little bit, but it's really unfortunate, right? And so who has money and who has power to get lawyers? Usually not people in East Oakland and West Oakland. And so that's a big problem. I did get off track, Freddie. I got on my soapbox.
This is definitely useful and helpful. But I do appreciate you giving us a sense of how wide the web is and where the economic piece fits into that and perfect. The power and the strength of the economic piece, but also contesting for authority and for power and for strength.
And it's true, right? The one phrase that I can tell you that I really love, which is people don't give you power, you take power, right? Mm-hmm. You have to go out there and fight for it. And so when parents are fighting for better schools in East Oakland, you know, the equivalent of what kids get in Montclair, that shouldn't be happening. It should be natural that they have better teachers, more equipped with skills, with master's degrees like you see in the Hill schools. No, they're getting brand new teachers, 1 and 2 years experience, and it makes a difference. It makes a difference to have experienced teachers. And so it's definitely been heartbreaking. More so than not, it's been heartbreaking to be a board member. And I've cried many, many nights. And knowing that at the end of 8 years, I tell people, I'm not going to be on the board, but I am not going away. Don't even think I'm going away. I'll be coming at you from a very different perspective, probably using my bar card.
All right. Excellent. Thank you, Lizzie. Okay, this is a question for each of you. In 1 minute or less, define defunding the police.
I'll go first. defunding the police 1 minute or less for OUSD meant repurposing the $6 million into the general budget. What we have been cutting for the last 8 years that I've been on the board, cutting every year, 15, 16, 20 million, you name it, laying people off. We can put that money towards school counselors. We have students who are going to be the first to graduate college, I mean high school, first to graduate high school. Don't you think they need a counselor to teach them what it's going to be to apply for college? They might be an immigrant student, and so their parents come from a whole different education system in somewhere in Asia or Latin America or wherever, Africa. So their parents don't know how to traverse college applications and SATs and all this stuff. So repurposing it for college counselors, repurposing it for mental health, repurposing it for just some basic bells and whistles at schools that have been going without, and because we know there are going to be problems, because we know there's going to be strife at schools, and we have lots of issues like not having grocery stores, so not having good, healthy food in certain neighborhoods, food deserts, we know we need restorative justice. We need restorative justice coordinators at every school. And so that's something we can do with $6 million, and that's tangible.
Thank you, Renzi. Chief?
Yeah, I say what it means to me is de-investing in things that law enforcement doesn't need to do anymore, right? I mean, recognizing, looking at the workload that we currently have in the city of Oakland and seeing what is it that the Oakland Police Department doesn't need to do anymore and who could be able to, who can do it and do it better. One of the things that, you know, I often say, I don't have any problem with defunding. I just, as a person that has spent his life around public safety, I want to make sure that when people pick up the phone and call in need, for whatever reason, whatever emergency they have, that there's a service on the other side, right? And so I think that's the issue for me. It doesn't matter to me, that it's the Oakland Police Department responding. What matters to me is that when people call because they're in need, that there's a service there to provide them the support that they need. And so that's what I see when I see defunding. I think, it's just making sure that we take the funds that appropriately should go somewhere else and then reallocate them there.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chief Armstrong. Dr. Moore, turn it back over to you.
So just thinking about, moving forward, right? We're having the conversations now, but what moving forward, what ways to create and improve trust within the community and law enforcement? So we're at this impasse. How do we push forward from here?
Well, I think really it is first the police department recognizing the community's call for change and demonstrating to the community that we hear them and making that change, right? And being transparent about the changes that are being made. I think there also needs to be a conversation about how we have to deal with public safety collectively, right? That if you really leave it to just the police department, this law enforcement institution, then, we still will have this gap and this mistrust, right? Public safety and the safety of our community really should be something that rests in the hands of all of us, right? Because if we're truly a community, everybody should care about what happens to each other. Right. And so this idea that we don't want to come outside our houses, we don't want to have conversations, we don't want to address issues in our community, it forces a police department to have a greater presence than maybe they even need to. Right. So if a neighbor is calling law enforcement because loud music is being played on the block and nobody can sleep and it's disturbing everybody's peace, really, that shouldn't be a law enforcement call, right? That should be a neighbor-to-neighbor conversation, right? That should be, just having this sort of understanding that, hey, I can call on my neighbor and say, hey, can you please turn the music down, instead of the need to call law enforcement, or there being a conflict or a confrontation because, I asked you to turn down the music. So I just figure out how we can institute some sort of conflict resolution in our community, so that we can handle things, right, without the need for law enforcement intervention, trying to be creative in different ideas about, even as we talked about restorative justice, right, really teaching community restorative justice, right? Some of these things that we're doing to one another might be easily solved by just working together and understanding this idea of sitting down and having a conversation and working those problems out without the need for law enforcement intervention and without the need for things to escalate to the point where violence might occur. So I just think, you know, different strategies, different things to help build trust. I think a reinvestment in community from this department to do more communicating with its community, more meeting with its community, and more responding to the needs of the community. I think one of the things that's always heartbreaking, even as a cop that lives in the city, is that nobody feels confident that if they pick up the phone and call 911, that they're going to see us for about 3-4 hours, or even in some cases a day, right? And so that's difficult, right? It's difficult to gain trust with people, with the community, if they don't feel like you are there when they need you. And so just figuring that out. But I also think, you know, the reality is that the numbers and the resources don't match up, right? I think the story has talked about it a little bit. If I tell you that there's 2,000 calls a day in the city of Oakland, and last year we received 750,000 calls for service in the city, the reality is that those are real people that have real problems and a real need for emergency services in most cases. And we responded to nearly 300,000 of those calls. And so the reality is that, you know, how do we deal with that? How do we deal with our community that is in need of police services? How do we deal with the issues that our community face? Violence is real. Crime is real. I had to go to homicide scenes of a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old this week. And so these are our young people, and so these things are real, that, you know, this is not in the abstract. And I know some people are saying, like, oh, just take them away. Well, we're not there yet, because when you deal with the families and you go to scenes where a young man was shot at 60 times, you know that people, 60 bullets didn't just have his name on it. That went through a whole entire community, and multiple people could have been injured as a result of that. Mm-hmm. How do we get people to understand the impact of their decisions to take actions like that in our community? And who all could be hurt as a result of those decisions, right? So I just think, you know, this is going to take us coming together collectively to establish a set of you know, expectations for each other about how we want to live in our community. We don't deserve to live in this way, right? We don't deserve, our young people don't deserve to feel unsafe. I have daughters that I'm afraid when they leave the house at night, and I'm a cop. I'm scared too. Call me when you get here. Send me your location, right? I didn't have to do all those things when I was growing up, but that's where we are as a community, that now you have to have your child check in everywhere they go. Send me your location because you're in fear of what could happen to them. That means we're not safe. And the question is, how do we get there? Maybe it's not police, but there has to be a solution to this, right? So that we all can rest at night knowing our children will get home safely, knowing that we don't have to be in fear of what could happen to us if we leave our homes.
Yeah. So, Ms. Torres, just from your perspective in regards to Oakland Unified School District, when we think about creating trust in the community and law enforcement, how do you see that moving forward being actualized?
Yeah, I think that with law enforcement, sometimes I'm in schools and I have students tell me, I want to be a police officer. And they're all diverse students, right? And they say, well, I want to be a police officer, and my brother's a police officer, or my cousin. And I think that one of the key things is hiring practices. And, you know, we know in the tech industry, there's people of color that get hired, but much like teaching, they don't stay because the culture pushes them out. It's very toxic in the tech industry because it's very white male. Even white women tell me they can't stay in that toxic culture. They have to create their own nonprofits or their own tech companies. So I think with the police department hiring practices, women of color, women, people from the community, which is oftentimes not what they want. They want people from outside who won't feel so sensitive to the community. It's interesting. And when I was a prosecutor, I felt that. Most of the police I was dealing with, they didn't live in Stockton. They lived in Sacramento. They lived in the foothills going towards Tahoe. And they didn't want to work and live in the same place because they just accepted that they weren't liked. They just accepted that they were seen as the enemy. And I thought, That was really strange. Even the prosecutors, most of them didn't live in Stockton. And that just makes me wonder, because that's the opposite, I think, of what you need, right? You need people to be from your community. I learn from my students, because I'm just learning here, right, the whole 8 years. My students say, if my teacher's from Oakland, she understands I live in a food desert where there's no grocery stores. She understands I have to walk past gangs to get to school, which means she knows how much I really want to get my education and get the heck out of here to go to college and have a better life and not be living in poverty. So we have teachers that come from outside, and they have no clue the struggle kids have, or that 16 and 17-year-olds are murdered, right? And kids are still coming to school, walking past that danger, because they want to go to college. And so it's really important, I think, that police departments are made up of people from a community that look like a community, especially more women, and especially more people who speak more languages. That the whole problem of not having someone who speaks Chinese, Arabic, Spanish, you name it, that's got to be very frustrating for community and for police. Right? Because you don't know what's going on if you can't communicate with that person who's calling 911. So I think that's important. I also think community knows from seeing Oscar Grant die needlessly, George Floyd die needlessly, Tamir Rice, you name it. I wasn't going to say her name, but I'm going to say it, Breonna Taylor, right? When people see these happen time and time again, what does the police departments typically say, or the unions? Well, you know, we're going to do better training. Do the training now. Don't wait for another innocent woman to be killed in her home, asleep, a child holding Skittles in Florida. So do the training to build the trust. Go out into community and build the trust, right? We know there were programs, I think, in the 90s, and Chief, correct me if I'm wrong, where we had a different lens about working with communities to build trust by having basketball programs at night when kids are out doing the things they shouldn't be doing, right? So basketball program at midnight, hanging out in the parks, having the students see you're just another human being. You chose that very visible job of being a police officer, but you care about the kids. And if you're out there in the community, you're also going to know maybe that child is from a single-parent home and there's not enough money, or mom is mentally ill, or lives with its grandmother, right? That student lives with its grandmother. So I think community policing can look very different. But being in the community, not always being in a car, right? Getting to know the local business owners. Guess what? The business owners' kids, they go to OUSD schools because they're not rich. They're not in private school. They're in the public school supporting us. Get to know the business owners as police officers. And I see that because I have clients who are business owners, and they definitely love the police officers on their beat, right? They feel very confident. Their kids might not, but the parents need to educate their kids. So those are a few things that I think of, because training is really everything, and creating that culture and creating that trust would change things dramatically, because instead of taking things into your own hands, right, because they're not going to come for 3 hours, or they're not going to come until tomorrow morning, I'm just going to take care of it myself. Why do we have so many weapons in this country? I mean, that's a bigger question. Why do we have so many cheap guns floating around on the streets? That's a different issue that comes from, in my opinion, white supremacy and the need to say, here, let's let them kill each other. Let's let them just take each other out. That's a really mind-boggling thing. You can have a whole 6-session series about. Why do we have so many weapons in this country? So those are just a few reflections.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Torres. And maybe something to include in the next social justice session ideas. I'll definitely keep that in the back of my mind. All right. So for you, Chief, and Ms. Torres kind of talked about this, but community policing. So what community policing strategies are currently being employed within the Oakland Police Department?
Yeah, so we practice community policing. I think we're in a unique situation in Oakland because we have a measure called Measure Z that funds community policing in the city of Oakland. It actually pays for community resource officers that are dedicated to community policing. I think there's a conversation across the city about what does community policing look like. And I think, you know, again, like we talked about earlier, we're working with our community right now to really reshape our community policing program. So we are working with our community policing advisory board from the city of Oakland, which is a group of our residents, right, really that have been appointed to that board to really have a lot of input into how we do community policing in the city of Oakland. We have our neighborhood crime prevention councils on every beat. And so our community resource officers respond to those community meetings and talks about the priorities for that particular community and responds to the needs of that community. The challenge is that, and I've heard this across the city, and I'm still trying to work through it, to be quite honest, is that community members often ask me, why don't the community policing officers do more walking, like Ms. Torres said, or why aren't they on the beat much more than they are? And the challenge for any department, and in the wake of George Floyd and the increase in protest activity throughout our city, and most of these protests are peaceful. So, you know, we're not like every other city that you've seen having a protest where people are demonstrating every day and destroy. We have had some protests that have been violent and some that have led to some vandalism, but that's not the norm, right? That's actually, that represents a very small percentage of all the protests, you know, or should I say, exercising the your freedom of speech, right, and exercising your First Amendment right to obviously peacefully protest. I think we in Oakland, that's who we are. That's a part of our history. That's a part of who we are, the fabric of this community. And so we understand that, and we've had hundreds of them that have been peaceful. So, but those do suck up resources, and we're not a department that has a lot of auxiliary resources throughout the city just malingering in our community, right? This is not NYPD where you see 40 to 50 cops in Times Square just standing around. We're not fortunate enough to have those resources, and quite honestly, we don't need those resources. But when we do have a major event, we have to pull resources from everywhere in the department in order to make sure that those events are safe. Sometimes officers are taken off the beat, and that impacts our ability to consistently have our community resource officers there in response to the community. So that's a challenge of how do we keep them on the beat. How do we get them to stay in those positions for a longer period of time so that they can build those relationships with community? I've seen it in my history of being a part of community policing is that it's most effective when the officer stays on the beat for a longer period of time and gets to know all of the people on his beat. If you're there for 2 or 3 years and you begin to cultivate those relationships where people can call you directly, you're solving problems for them, they have a tremendous amount of confidence in your ability to be responsive to their needs, then that helps to build trust. Because at minimum, they know my community police officer is here. He's walking around. I can call him. He'll address these problems. We need to get back to that. We need to get back to a place where we have the time to provide that level of service to our community, and that's what we're looking forward to doing in the future.
All right. Well, one last question posed to the both of you from me right now. In what ways can Oakland Unified School District and Oakland Police Department collaborate?
Can you say it again?
What ways can the OUSD and the Oakland PD collaborate?
Well, I think it's going to be a big shift in that collaboration is something inevitable with regard to my resolution, George Floyd resolution, to defund our police department, right? All that money gets repurposed in the general budget. So now, you can't call an OUSD police officer, well, not now, but as of December, that will get closed. So the collaboration's going to have to be really strong, as it was probably before we had a police department in the districts, because we didn't always have that. Again, you know, things can change and should change and be looked at from time to time as life, you know, progresses and society changes and so on. And we become more aware of what our system has been designed to do and doing very well, locking up people of color in prisons across California, private prisons, no less, for profit. So in any event, I think that we can't try to task the police department with doing all of the mental health work. You know, if we have students that have problems that they bring to school and they're a danger to themselves or others, That is for counselors. That is for professionals that can deal with the de-escalation tactics. So I think that it's important that the school district collaborate with the department and the specific people in the police department that will be the liaisons with the county of Alameda. So that's another agency we haven't talked about much, but the county of Alameda, right? So we got the city of Oakland that should be doing more to the police. We got the county of Alameda that has the biggest budget, and they give money to the city. So we can go right to the source of the well. The county can do more, and I've advocated in front of our county supervisors, right, who are elected, to give us more money as a district for earmarked things like mental health, like restorative justice coordinators. So if we all work together and took a fresh pause about how we all can bring more money to the table and more targeted resources, I think we can do a better job that we wouldn't have teachers calling and saying, get me the police. This kid is out of control. Let's, you know, send him to the office. Let's expel him. Where is he going to go? I mean, I'm very troubled by if a teacher is overly zealous and anti, you know, whatever, and doesn't have her own resources and skills to try to work with that student and that parent, maybe, then it's dismissive to just say, well, let's just let law enforcement deal with it, or let's just let the district expel this student or even suspend. Where do you think that student physically goes? Out into the street, because now it's on school, out into the street, into the hands of people who are like, I got a job for you, delivering this little package of stuff. You can make some easy money. So I find it to be quite the opposite of what we should do with students who are having trouble, right? Why are we going to suspend them? Now they're losing precious minutes of instruction. It's the last thing that kid needs. Expelling them, you know, we put them in alternative programs, and OUSD has done a good job of the alternative schools that are smaller, and they can keep a better watch, and then they can get their GPA up, and then they can get back into the regular mainstream schools and classrooms. But I definitely think that with the George Floyd resolution, you're going to see, and OUSD has created a working group made up by BOP and other community members and people in RJ, Restorative Justice, that are going to propose what is it going to look like as of January, as we have no police department, what will it look like when XYZ goes down? Because before it was, we were too quick to just call the police. And what I started with earlier was, as soon as students start having contacts with police, whether it be the Oakland School District or the city or the sheriff even, or the BART police, that student is now tainted, right? And they're going to have repeat contacts, and eventually that could lead to the prison pipeline or even juvie. So I think it's going to be amazing to have BOP at the table creating this policy of what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. It's exciting. For me, it's very exciting. And like I said, I'm not going away just because I'm not there in January.
Thank you. All right, Chief, what does collaboration look like between Oakland Police Department and OUSD?
You know, obviously, as the city police department, this is one of those collaborations that you don't have a choice but to be a part of, right? So, you know, I think we welcome being at the table and coming up with solutions that work for the district, right? We want to be supportive of progressive ideas and trying to provide the best level of public safety we can for our students in our city, right? And so we're going to sit down at the table. We know that this will be additional work, right? And I continuously say, we talk about defunding, but we're adding more work, right? And then we want you to do it better, right? And faster. And so all of those things take resources, right? Human resources. And so we'll figure out how we, the course of moving forward. I will say that I think, you know, in the past, we've obviously worked with BOP and others about progressive ideas about how we can provide safety off campuses and then intercampus when there's a need to be on campus. And so recognizing that, we are prepared to sit down and have those conversations. And we also, we've been fortunate enough to also take on Peralta Colleges too, because they have decided to also in their a contract with the Alameda County Sheriff's Department. So we also have taken on Merritt College and Peral and Laney College as well. So I think this is a conversation that we're looking forward to having. What does, you know, public safety on those campuses look like? How do we want to work with community-based organizations that might be providing services like, like restorative justice? When I was a school commander serving OUSD previously, we did have all of our school officers at that time trained in restorative justice, and that was a recommendation, again, that we worked with the district about being able to have our officers specially trained in certain areas. And so we'll meet the needs of the district, and I think we'll figure out how Oakland can be one of the most progressive departments and cities in the country, and maybe we can be a model for other districts on how you can remove police officers from schools but still provide safety on campuses. And so we're open to that conversation. That's my mindset. And so, we're in a situation, and I understand with Ms. Torres and why she wanted police officers off campus. I agree that, when you have an interaction with law enforcement, that has an impact. And we also know that studies show that when young people face arrest, that starts a trajectory that leads to a negative outcome. And so if we can prevent that pipeline, that entry into the criminal justice system from occurring, then I'm definitely on board with that.
Thank you for that. Thank you both for that, actually.
It almost seemed like we practiced, Tom, but we didn't.
Right. I thought we had to get some teachers here, but it's
like-minded.
On the same page.
We're like-minded.
Yes.
That's why I chose to raise my kid here. I moved her from Stockton for her to go to school as a kindergartner, and I said, I can't raise her in Stockton because I did some things when I was in high school that I'm not proud of. And I really feel proud of raising a child who has such a diverse group of friends from kindergarten till now at college. And it's just what a difference it would have made in my life to be raised in a city like this. And Stockton has its fine points, but definitely I'm proud to be here, and I'm proud to have my business here, and I'm proud to serve as an elected for 8 years. And so it's exciting. I feel excited about the change that's coming, and I feel excited that we can even say the words white fragility, white supremacy, anti-blackness, anti-immigrant. The fact that we're saying the things that I ran in my mind in 2012 thinking about my experience, and now we're saying it out loud, what I'm thinking, but worried that people would say I'm calling them racist. It's not that the particular teachers are racist. It's a culture in the school, and they're ascribing to it. And they could be black or they could be brown, and they're still sometimes falling in line to a culture that is not kind to that little child that is black or brown or learning English, and parents are not able to communicate with the teacher. And so there's a lot of negative things that have been happening in our schools for years that no one would say out loud. And now I feel like we have this freedom to say it, to call it out, and to require and demand that our superintendent and her staff train everybody from the cafeteria worker to the janitor to the teachers to the office workers. It's everybody's responsibility to treat every child with respect,
We've come a long way. We still got a ways to go, but at least having those
conversations.
And I definitely hear you, Ms. Torres, about just being able to say the words and creating a space to hold these conversations that are very necessary.
That's right. And difficult. They're very difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So I think now we're going to move to a couple of questions. Freddie, if you want to kind of check in with the questions. So these are from the audience. Our panelists.
So audience Q&A, and any of the participants, if you want to add your question in the Q&A box, which should be just adjacent to the regular chat box, please input your question there. You've gotten some questions from early on. So let me see here. All right, first question, and this is for you, Chief, from James V. You use the phrase reimagine policing that seems like the end goal of the defund the police movement. But when the defund the police phrase gained national prominence, supporters immediately had to explain what they meant with the phrase. Do you find that within the law enforcement community at large, there's an openness to reimagining policing versus a defensiveness that defund the police elicits? In short, does a different framing help the defund the police movement?
Yeah, that's a great question. I do believe that the reframing, I believe, is more in touch with the realistic, outcomes that we might see, right? I think, and I think it's also in alignment with the city, right? That our city council voted to create a reimagining policing task force to really look at how much of the Oakland Police Department budget they could cut and reallocate to other services. And so I think that's consistent with what I've been saying tonight. It's just looking at all of the things that we do and seeing what is not appropriate for us to do any longer and figuring out if there's a funding source attached to that, maybe that could be funds that could be reallocated to somebody else or some other organization that might be able to do that better, and which is fine. But I also say that, I think when you start saying defunded, you're thinking about that these are people, right? These are human beings that have families, right? These are people who have careers that is fearful and obviously defensive, right? That people, have to take care of their families too. So obviously that when they hear defunded, I know Ms. Torres know this, when you're talking about layoffs, right, that brings out emotions in people, right? And that if you ever want to see the worst in people, talk about touching their livelihoods, right? But we as law enforcement, as a leader and as a chief, you have to be able to communicate to them what this means in reality. You have to be able to have discussions with our elected officials and just get an understanding of how this process is going to work. All we want to be is open and transparent. Police departments have to, get in line with the values of their community. And if that, and just like Ms. Torres pushed forward an initiative to end policing in schools, we have to be responsive to what our community says is in the best interest of Oakland at the end of this process. And I'm sure we won't be happy. Everybody won't be happy as a result of this. But I think it's a fair and open process that they had over 200 people that submitted applications to be a part of this reimagining task force. And so that shows the level of interest that we have in our community with being a part of that conversation. You're happy that people in Oakland want to be about change, right? They want to have a voice in change. And so that's who we are as a community. I understand that. But I do think that when you say to people, particularly employees, right, my staff defunded, they, they think of the worst, right? They think that means my family is in jeopardy. And we want to just try to reassure them we're going to do everything we can to keep them abreast of the process and make sure they understand sort of what these things mean, what these cuts might mean in the long term, right, in the long run. And so that's why we reframe it, because we do have employees on the other side. We have people that we want to make sure they go out there every day feeling confident. You also don't want to communicate in a way in which it makes your community unsafe, right? Because when people start to figure, if you uncut all these people, then I might as well hit the heels and leave now, right, and go to another police department. And then you have a gap and you don't have the proper amount of services in your community to address your issues. And now all of a sudden, crime is going up and people are being hurt and injured as a result. So, and our response time goes down even more, right? It's already dismal and with loss of resources. It takes 8 or 9 months just to get a police officer on the streets and a year process through the hiring process. So when we lose officers, it's a huge amount of time that it takes to rebuild that force back up.
And I would add to that when I do say that I'm proud of the George Floyd resolution, I received the benefit of the police department to the extent that there was a violent situation and a superintendent was killed at a board meeting by this extremist group in the 70s. So we had police from our OUSD police department at all of our board meetings, and they were at the doors, monitoring the scenario, what was happening and stuff. And you're not going to get a more emotional group than a parent who's pissed off that you're cutting the budget of their school, or you're cutting the librarian, or you're shuttering the library, or whatever, after school program, you name it. You're not going to get a more emotional and impassioned group because it's your child. But one of the things with regard to defunding the police, because we have all these security officers at campuses, one aspect of that, and there's like 75 or something, was that we needed to not have security officers as much as how I envisioned it with working with BOP and working with community organizations that were also down for this cause, was what if we had peacekeeping ambassadors? What if we had people who were more trained on the peacekeeping aspect of the school culture, the RJ, the restorative practices, de-escalating when there's going to be violence or they hear there's going to be a fight after school? That is different. Security officers are there with a badge, maybe with some mace or what have you, but a peacekeeping ambassador is a different lens. It's a different reimagined perspective that these are young people. Their brain is not fully developed. It's apparently not till you're 25. So they're making choices that are not always in their best interest and definitely not in their classmate that they don't like who they're about to attack. But they are young, and so we need someone to take a different approach and wear a different uniform and wear a different lens that, okay, I need to help these young people so they don't get kicked out of school, right? So I'm happy that we're not just kicking all these people to the curb. We're saying there's going to be this new position because schools still need someone to help manage the campus. We're not just putting kids in this complete vulnerable position. So that's something I'm also very proud of, and that's what they're working on in this committee now. What will that look like?
Thank you, Rosie. It looks like we just lost the chief. Hopefully he can rejoin because we got a couple of questions here for him. But I will swing one your way, Rosie. So let's see. Question is, when you said to sue the school for change, how would one do that, especially if one were to be poor? So if you're impoverished, how do you leverage that economic threat?
So there are a few different things I can touch on. One, there are students that are special education qualified. So again, a learning disability or lots of interruptions to education from maybe being unstable in housing. So you're moving a lot, you're missing school, and now you're way behind, maybe 2-3 grade levels behind. That's a form of disability, and that comes from poverty. Because if you owned your home, you wouldn't be moving, right? You wouldn't be getting evicted from apartments, slumlords, so on and so forth. So there's a different stability when you have money when you don't. And so there are attorneys that specialize in the law of education and special education in particular, and they're paid by the school district when the case is resolved. So the family never has to give a dime to the lawyer. The lawyer files a lawsuit under the educational laws that this student is not getting the proper and appropriate education for their disability, right? So that's one way. Any family can hire an education lawyer, and the statute says that lawyer is going to get paid from the school district's budget. So that's one thing. And we have to deal with lawsuits every month. Been up there 8 years almost, and every month we hear the lawsuits about special education and how much they're settling for and how much are the lawyer's fees. They break it down. So that's one thing. No money out of the pocket of the family. If it's something different, but that's some pervasive problem. There is a lawsuit you can look up, students, called Vergara, V-E-R-G-A-R-A. The Vergara lawsuit was students from multiple districts that got together, primarily Black, Brown, Asian Pacific Islander students, and they sued the state over what was happening in education, that students were being told, rather than have minutes of instruction in classrooms, they were taking alternative ed, like, you know, you get electives, and the elective might have been cleaning up the bathrooms or shuffling papers in the office. So that was not instruction. That was actually almost becoming like an employee, but working for free. So Vergara lawsuit touched on many points that you see in communities of poverty, primarily of color, where students were not getting proper minutes of instruction. They were not getting the textbooks that they were due by the law. They were not getting, you know, experienced teachers. They had teacher turnover, so they'd have substitutes all year, and the substitutes were giving out the proper schoolwork and giving the proper lecture for that matter. So when the chief said, I went away to go to college and realized not as prepared as other people, right? That's what also happened. And in Vergara, they sued and said, we're not being prepared because we're not even getting a full 7-hour school day. We're getting like 5 hours or 5.5 because we've got this elective and there's no real teacher because the teacher quit. And now there's a substitute, you know, constantly coming in. And so we're not just getting anything. So Vergara was a lawsuit that was taken up by nonprofit organizations that are made up of lawyers that want to see education quality increase and improve in California. So they go out and they seek private donors who can write checks for $100,000, $500,000, $1 million, because some people got it like that. And they made their money, and now they're giving back to community. And they go out, and there's an organization called Akonati here in Oakland. That the person who started Akonati inherited significant billions, and she founded Akonati, which is a civil rights, like social justice organization. So she's using that wealth for good. And so there's a lot of people out there with a lot of money, and that's how the lawyers were funded in the Vergara lawsuit. So I'm just, you know, trying to say that money circulates, right? What we need is more people from Oakland to go out, be successful, come back, have major millions or billions, and then circulate your wealth. Start nonprofits, fund nonprofits, continue the good stuff going. So.
Excellent. Thank you, Rosie. Chief, sorry that we lost you there.
Yes.
Happy to
be back. The city of Oakland has been having technical difficulties all day. And you can imagine all of us around the entire city are in a tailspin because every time we're on Zoom, the Zooms has been going down. So luckily we lasted a couple of hours.
All right. Yeah. All right. Well, I've got one question for you. Do you believe that OPD and thousands of other PDs can use funds to extend the length of the academy? 6 months does not seem like enough training time. Considered doctors, therapists, teachers, etc., require years of experience and training before becoming licensed to work in their chosen fields. So using funds, reallocating funds to extend the amount of training in the academy.
I like it,
but I don't think that communities are interested in giving any additional funds to law enforcement. But what I will say is that it's actually a little longer than 6 months. And so I want to be clear that the academy in Oakland is about 28 weeks. So it's a 7-month academy. It also comes with an additional 4 months of field training. So in actuality, it ends up being around 11 months. And the average officer, even in field training, is extended, what we call, they're given another 3 or 4 weeks as in the field training program to make sure they get it and understand. So we're talking about a year before an officer is actually fully trained police officer and able to ride by themselves, right, and actually take calls without the assistance of a training officer. And so that's a year process. And I think, you know, one of the things I do want to, you know, make it clear is that police officers are mandated to receive a number of hours of training a year. So for us, it's ongoing training, right? And then to be a progressive police department, we have done more training than any other department, probably in the state, simply because we're under a negotiated settlement agreement that requires us to provide much more training than everybody else. But also, it's our recognition that these are very serious jobs. Officers are making very critical decisions, life-taking decisions in some cases. And so one of the things that we've overly invested in is de-escalation. So we're giving our officers 30 additional hours of de-escalation a year when they're only mandated to have 4 hours every 18 months. So police officer standards and training, our certifying commission for the state of California requires an officer qualified with 4 hours of training, firearms training every within an 18-month period. The Oakland Police Department, we require somewhere in the range of between 30 and 40 hours of training, most of that training being not firearms training, but actually de-escalation training. putting officers in simulators and taking them through scenario-based training to really put them under stress and test their ability to make decisions under stress. And so if you look at the data that we have in the police department, I think people often think that we've been involved in a lot of officer-involved shootings and excessive force cases, but that's actually not reflective in the data. We haven't actually shot an African-American man in 5 years. But this is not what, you know, this is not what it was like when I first came, where we averaged 8 fatal shootings a year. And so we've had 3 fatal shootings in the last 3 years. And so these things, you know, I believe training is vital, putting officers in these environments where they can make decisions. We can put them under stress, the same stress that they would feel if they were actually in the field, so that we can watch them and assess them and make them go to the brink of pulling the firearm and making that shoot or don't shoot decision. That's critical. And I thank the city because they invested $400,000 into a new simulator machine that we're currently, that'll be completed next week. It is the most advanced de-escalation training machine in the country. It's made by a company called Virtra. It is a virtual reality, so they will be in a 3D like theater, and they will be taken through real life scenarios, ones in which we can even create that model our own city. So we can create scenarios that make the studio look like it's an actual street in Oakland or one of our significant locations in Oakland. And so that's how we really are trying to do our best to move, be at the forefront in policing. I think, you know, we've done several things in terms of even body camera. We were the first department to equip every police officer with the body camera. And we're the only police department in the country that is working with Stanford, a top-ranked university, to actually analyze that body-worn camera footage. Most departments don't want to allow access to body-worn camera footage to the public, let alone allow an academic institution to study it. We have allowed an academic, and the report that came back from that study wasn't positive. But being a learning organization, that analysis allowed us to learn what was actually happening in our community, and that our police officers were interacting with our African-American community differently than they were interacting with our white community. And so that was a lesson learned from us by allowing an academic institution to do research on our body-worn camera footage. But it also allowed us to change policy, right, and provide training and bring that to our officers' attention to get them to change their behavior. And so that's what I think law enforcement needs to get into, accepting the fact that that we can do better, allowing ourselves to be analyzed to figure out what it is that we're doing that we can be better at, and how we can change policy and practice. And so that's what we're doing here. It's not always popular to the officers, but I think it is popular to the community because it's about how we interact with our community, and it's about how community perceives us. And so if there's a way in which we can do better, we should seek to do that.
Excellent. Thank you. I'm going to combine a few questions here, and this just might be the last question. There is some interest from some of our participants around hearing both of your thoughts in terms of a redistribution of funds and a refocus or a retraining that is geared towards addressing mental health, incidents of mental health crises in the community, both in the school and both in the broader community. What are your thoughts around that, around pivoting towards addressing mental health crisis instances from a policing perspective and also from a redistribution of funds, whereas instead of perhaps hiring a police officer, maybe you then hire, create, or train a mental health specialist?
If I can go first, because if it's the last question, I'll let Ms. Torres have the last words. I'm just...
Thank you.
This is pretty straightforward question for us. I think that's one of the things, like I spoke of earlier, that the department has been in support of, is funding more people who have mental health training to provide that support to our communities, and having less police officers with a gun and a badge respond to calls where people are dealing with some mental illness challenges. So that's the first thing that we've been committed to. We're actually working currently with the city, the Department of Violence Prevention, on the creation of the MACRO program. That'll be Oakland's program that is a non-police officer response to mental health issues. So we are right at the table. What people don't know about the Oakland Police Department is that we're the leading agency in Northern California for crisis intervention training. So all of our police officers have been trained in crisis intervention, an 80-hour training that teaches them how to interact with those that are suffering from some mental illness challenge. We also have the subject matter expert for the state of California, Sergeant Doria Neff, that actually teaches police officers around the state on crisis intervention, and she's ours. She also teaches, and we certify all of the crisis intervention trained police officers in the whole East Bay. And so we are the training facility for all police officers. So really, we are the leaders in how we train our officers to deal with the mentally ill. And I'll say that over my long 22, 23-year career, I can see the dramatic difference in how we interact with this community, with the mentally ill community. And I say that because when I came on, everybody assumed that we needed to use force in order to handle the situation, right? That there's something going on, we need to immediately go in and we need to restrain this person. And so the training has really reformed how we view these situations. It's caused us to change our tactics and how we address them. And we've seen our reductions in force go down tremendously, right? Now that officers know how to communicate, how to create time and distance, how to give people space. And then we also partner with Alameda County Mental Health Department. So we actually have mental health clinicians that ride with us. And we have them in our community every day. And when calls of mental illness come out, they are the first responders when available. So although we have the trained officers, the first priority is to get a mental health specialist there first. So those are some of the things we're doing to address it.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you.
So I would say that, you know, what the chief was just saying is probably the best news, in the sense that the training is one thing. I also think, you know, if you have specialized officers, like if you have special units, or not special units, but every shift, if you have officers that are known for having that, the proclivity, right, the desire to do even more training than is required. So if it's 80 hours on mental health issues or whatever the hours are, and it could probably be changing as repurposing is going to happen with the budget, I think that there are also people who say, you know, I really enjoy this aspect of policing more than anything else. So could I do more training? Could I be known as the person who specializes? It's the same thing in many careers. I mean, as lawyers, some people are general and some people just know, I only wanted to do X type of law ever since I was a little kid, whatever. And many teachers, same thing. There's teachers that said, I only wanted to teach math and that's it. I only want to teach science and that's it. So what about giving specialized, additional special training for officers, so you always have somebody per shift? That would be one thing. And I think that in schools, it's the same thing. If there are steps before you have to deal with law enforcement, so, you know, before it gets to making that 911 call, it should be having the resources, which is why I mentioned the county. The county can give us more money, or the county can have more resources that our teachers and our school staff can then call and say, this person specializes in youth from 12 to 18, right, middle school to high school. And this person, these people specialize in kindergarten through fifth grade, you know, the younger children. I was shocked and disgusted that we were actually suspending, when we started looking at the data and Bob and I started working together, students were suspended, primarily black boys, in elementary as young as first and second and third grade. And I thought to myself, what did he do? Like, what does a first, second, third grader do that warrants suspension? That's out of control, right? So I've met amazing teachers who say, I love teaching, and I know when I have a student that's acting out, it's not that that student is a problem, it's that that kid has some problems, right? So we got to get underneath that. And so if every teacher was trained to think that way, and they're not, that would be such a different world in schools. And so I definitely, you know, it's a lot of coordination between the police department, the city, other agencies, the mental health hospitals. I think we've been, as a society, underfunding and under-focused on dealing with mental health problems because it's so complicated. But worse than that is that it's so expensive. It's expensive. And when it's expensive, we just don't even do it. And that's why, like, Prop 13, you know, it's made it so that even the basic thing is too expensive, like having sports or like having college counselors. It's pretty sad. So I think we're on the trajectory of switching things. And someone wrote in the comments that it's Prop 15, which is to undo Prop 13's damage for all these decades since the 70s, and it would tax commercial and industrial property more appropriately for 2020 and beyond. And so that's what we need everybody to vote on. And they're going to do a really great job in the next 3.5 weeks of trying to, or 4 weeks, to convince people that Prop 13 is bad and it's going to cost you more to go to Disneyland. Whatever. Don't go to Disneyland then. So, you know, it's going to cost us more to have people in prison and in society to be having young people die at the hands of guns. And so that costs. Crime always costs more. Crime always costs more than if the kids got a great education. They'd be tax-paying citizens. So I think that's, you got to flip that on its head.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Rosie, so much. Thank you, Chief Armstrong, very much. Don't go to Disneyland, but go to Fairyland and help people.
Go to Fairyland.
Right? Right? In our parks here in Oakland.
That's right.
I think that's a good place to end. We certainly want to thank you both very much and thank all of our participants for coming in. I know there was a couple of questions we didn't get to answer. I do apologize for that, but we just want to honor time. Perhaps Ms. Torres and Chief Armstrong, if you feel like sharing contact information in the chat so people can contact either of you if they have any specific questions, please do so. And I'll turn it over to Dr. Moore to close us out.
All right, so just kind of piggybacking off of what Freddie said, thank you to both of our guests. I think this was a really great, informative conversation, given different perspectives, but it's really interesting the collaborative kind of thread that was interwoven throughout the conversation, even without us being aware of it. So I think there's a lot of hope and optimism and optimistic possibilities in regards to the collaboration, the way that the police are going to be responding, and the way that the school district is empowering its students, its personnel, and really making appropriate demands to respond to the needs of the community overall. So again, thank you to our esteemed panelists. I will be in touch with you both for sure. And thank you to everyone who was in attendance. This was a great program. Thank you to my co-host, Freddie, and the Center for Social Justice. And shout out to the criminology program as well. Do not forget, our next session will be in 2 weeks. We will be discussing the impact of COVID-19 in regards to prison reform. So I look forward to seeing you all there. And thank you all again. Have a good one.
Great. Good night. Thank you.